Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandergrift.
It's Monday, July 29th. From HBR2, it's The Conversation. Today on the show, same sex, lots more cash. But is it enough?
What's really revealed when the lights go out?
Bagging human decency, that ain't a way to treat kapuna.
Southern blues Hawaiian style, let it slide.
Add in the Al Jazeera World Report, a mistaken backyard deity, and a not-so-fine excuse in today's reality check.
Support for NPR comes from Lumosity.com, dedicated to improving memory and attention with neuroscience-based games for the brain at Lumosity.com.
Good morning. This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. And good morning to you, Mr. Vandercook.
Good morning to you. Welcome back, Beth Ann. You had a week off.
It was nice to be away, but always good to be back.
Good to have you.
And it was good to have Lynn Waters here, and many thanks to her for being here. So, on with today. If you took an economics class in college, well, you couldn't have escaped without learning the relationship between supply and demand. When supply is low and demand is high, prices shoot skyward. Hawaii may soon have the chance to participate in that basic equation by granting one of the basics in economic stability, marriage, specifically for same-sex couples. With Hawaii's reputation as a wedding wonderland and honeymoon heaven, joining the 25% of states already allowing gay marriage would open up a whole new market. And that could attract a financial fantasy into reality, according to UH economics professor and research fellow Sumner LaCroix, who joins us from, where are you, New York?
I'm in New York, yes.
Well, lucky you. Are you there?
I am here, yes.
Okay, thought for a second we lost you there. Well, you're over on the other side of the country where there are many states, but at least nine of them, which already have gay marriage. But as we look at this in the financial context of Hawaii, $217 million sounds like a lot. This was one of the scenarios that you looked at back in February. How good are these numbers now?
Well, you know, back in February, I put together, along with a student at the law school, Lauren Gabriel, I put together a report on the impact of marriage equality in Hawaii. And that report didn't have the benefit of the two Supreme Court decisions. We didn't really know what the Supreme Court was going to do in the California marriage case and in the case on the Defense of Marriage Act. So that report had all these different contingencies of what if the Supreme Court does this, what if the Supreme Court does something else, what if it upholds the law, what if it overturns it. So in this report, since we have the benefit of those two decisions, I decided I'd just try to update the report and try to get a better estimate of what the effects would be for Hawaii. And they're quite large. The $217 million is not a small amount of money in an economy that's only roughly $70 billion. It is a large amount of money.
It's a large amount of money in a time when, obviously, we're trying to make up shortfalls over the last couple of years and get ahead of the game. But is this a case, Sumner, where we're chasing money and not looking at the ramifications first? Will the money be enough to pull people along and draft it toward creating same-sex marriage in Hawaii?
Well, you know, I don't think there's really all that many people that are necessarily going to vote for same-sex marriage on the basis of monetary benefits. I think most of the people who are considering their votes are looking at it for other reasons, whether or not it's the right and just thing to do or whether or not people oppose same-sex marriage. But, you know, these are benefits that are somewhat time-sensitive. Because of the two Supreme Court decisions, there is a pent-up demand now in the United States by same-sex couples to marry. They realize that there's a lot of benefits that they could get access to, and that now that the federal government recognizes their marriage, they're going to get these benefits. And so my prediction is that instead of having about 5% of couples in these marriage states marry, we're going to have about 10% marry. Essentially, the demand for marriage has risen considerably, and that those couples are going to marry sometime over the next 3 years, and that they're only going to be able to marry in states in which in states which are marriage equality states, states which have legalized same-sex marriage. And so for Hawaii, there's a limited time window in which we're likely to get a good number of couples coming here to marry, couples coming here to honeymoon, and then there's also the guests, people who come to marriage celebrations and people who come to attend weddings. Spending by the guests is also quite significant. When you mound it all up and then look at the multiplier spending, it also comes from this original spending by the married couples who come here to honeymoon, marry, and by their guests. It's a large amount of money. But it is something that if we waited for, say, 3 years, we would find that much of this money just isn't going to be there.
So
it's one of those things that if we want to do same-sex marriage, it would really be good to do it sooner rather than later.
So, Sumner, we're really looking at a bubble, aren't we?
We are looking at a little bit of a bubble. This is a period when we're likely to find that there's just a large number of couples that are looking to marry into honeymoon. And Hawaii is a big honeymoon state. For couples in the mainland United States. A large percentage of U.S. couples honeymoon here. And I have no doubt that the gay and lesbian couples would be no different, that a large percentage of them would also come to Hawaii to honeymoon.
At some point when that 3 year window goes away, what bump did you look at would happen after that we might see as a residual effect, or have you looked at that yet?
No, I haven't looked at that. And that spending does disappear. We then move down to much more normal spending. There's then just a normal flow of people, but it is something. It's additional spending that can be reaped for the next 3 years. But afterwards, the percent of same-sex couples that are going to marry does go down. But you know, given that right now we have a good number of hotel rooms, particularly on the neighbor islands, that are still empty. I think this is something where even if they become empty in the future, it's great to fill them for the next 3 years.
At least take the opportunity to recoup what money we can, particularly if it's a lot of money on the table right now.
Absolutely. You know, it's one of those time sensitive spending trails. And yeah, it is going to disappear in the future. This isn't permanent spending.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your holiday in New York, and we'll see you when you come back to our shores.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Sumner LaCroix is professor in the Department of Economics and the Global Health and Population Studies Program at the University of Hawaii Manoa. He's also a research fellow with the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization. UHERO's report on what Hawaii stands to gain by allowing same-sex marriage is on hpr2.org. This is The Conversation on member-supported HBR2. Later in the show, what goes up when the lights go out and some caffeinated conversation. First, a fast-forward to fall, Hawaiian style.
Ulana, umau, ukaholabe, uhawaiti.
Fall isn't far away, and that means makahiki season. In the old Hawaiian calendar, it was a time of relaxation and fun. The celebration of the land's bounty was more than a harvest festival. Hawaii's growing season spans most of the year. So to mark the year-round plenty, chiefs collected crops, fish, and livestock as offerings to Lono, the god of fertility. The traditional makahiki started in autumn and ran through winter. War was kapu, forbidden, so Lono's image could pass unhindered through all the heiau. In the makahiki of 1778, another visitor also arrived, Captain James Cook. Hawaiians greeted him with lavish gifts and religious ceremony, but the captain's arrival was much more than a friendly welcome. Most saw it as Lono in the flesh because of certain details about Cook's appearance. For today's backyard quiz, do you know what caused the mix-up? Stay tuned and you'll know later in the show. Meanwhile, let's go get some coffee.
Every Monday, we check the caffeine and conversation pulse at a coffee hotspot. Today, Bill Sage is out at Waimanalo Beach Cafe and Gallery. Good morning, Bill. What's brewing?
Good morning, Beth Ann. Today, we are talking with Joseph Ipa and Gerald Chong, and they are talking about everyday warriors at Waimanalo. Now, we don't have too much time, so let's get right to it. On this kind of stormy, flossy day, related to Gerald, you were born and raised Waimanalo side, is that correct?
Yes.
Gerald, we're going to go Gerald first. Okay. Let me stretch out the mic here. It's kind of hemajang tangles. Here we go. The project you're talking about is Everyday Warriors.
Yes, it's a video project. You know, we're hoping to pitch it as a reality show, like on one of the networks, or even locally here on Olelo or something. And it's just basically a reality show where we go and interview people who are fighting the everyday battle to survive in modern-day Hawaii, you know.
You were just mentioning that in Hawaii, even the act of getting up off the okoli and just getting healthy so you can fight the battles better is actually part of major part of the problem?
Yeah, I think, you know, with America facing competition and threats from China and abroad, you know, we need to get in better shape. I mean, I hate to say that about the American public, but I feel that we need to get off the drugs, eat better, just get in shape. So because we cannot be in this condition and expect to compete with guys from China or India that are really, you know, hustling and you know, taking over the world economy.
Not just in terms of business, but education and everything else?
All of that. We need to get our children educated. We need to get up and go. We need leadership. And, you know, and it starts in every home, every community.
Thank you very much, Gerald. Right now, Joseph Ipa, you were born and raised in Waimanalo, so this is part of your project too?
I just want to correct that. I came out into Waimanalo in 1972. Gerald is born and raised in Waimanalo, and he has seen the difference of how it is today to where he came from the beginning. And what Gerald has said, what he wants to do for the community is to educate the existing parent now and then to travel more into the future with the children's education.
So the key is education.
The key is education. Let the people know that, you know, it's time to get off your okoli and start doing something for the kids.
Okay. So we can do it for the kids by getting up off our okolis, and we could probably do it to get up off the okolis, maybe get some more water, get some more batteries. Flossie might be passing us by soon, but out at Waimanalo Cafe, we're getting plenty of energy because the caffeine is flowing. The caffeine will be flowing next week, too, and if I don't swallow another bit of air, I'm not going to choke on the air. So before I make complete A, I'll go back to the studio and say, see you next week. Aloha.
Now from hot coffee to a hot time. Human behavior often changes when the lights go out. When electrical power disappears, we have to find other ways to light up the night. Hawaii's experiences with major power outages may not exactly rank with a night in New York City more than 40 years ago. We tend to think we more easily engage with each other every day. But on that New York night, people in a city of isolated souls began to actually talk to one another. Hawaii playwright Jan McGrath looks at the lights that come on when everything goes dark in her new play, Outage, which is in rehearsal now, and she joins us in our studio. Good morning, Jan.
Good morning, Chris.
Was that what kind of stimulated this play, the whole idea that behavior shifts when suddenly we're without something we depend on?
That sort of came second, I think. It started when I saw the Love, Loss, and What I Wore, the Nora Ephron play.
Sure.
And I saw these two characters in this encounter, and I, you know, the writer goes, "What if?" And it was sort of, "What if they were back in my silent generation?"
Mm-hmm.
And so they became the two focal characters of the family.
Are they a mother and daughter then?
No. Those two characters are life partners of 20 years, Lily and Peg. And Lily is a lit professor. Her ex-husband, Bill, it's a very tight little odd family for that time, mm-hmm. takes place in 1982. And the daughter, Jeannie, is a doctor without borders. And it takes place in the overnight. Jeannie's come home to get married. And in the overnight, and Lily is already under stress. She's facing a life-threatening disease. And, of course, the joyful stress of a child getting married. And then the lights go out. And then all of a sudden, whatever's already been going on just kind of compresses around them.
Well, you have about a half dozen sort of incipient elements, don't you?
Exactly.
A birth about to happen, a relationship, past relationships, the shadow of them.
Yeah, and that's what the lights do. I mean, they just make them sort of suddenly really look at,
mm-hmm.
and they have these intimate confrontations about who they are.
Well, that, you know, that's kind of, in a way, that's kind of the basics of playwriting, isn't it? You create some characters, you make people get to know them, and we would hope care about them, and then something happens.
Yep.
You catalyze them.
One trigger.
In some kind of ways.
Yeah.
And a power outage is kind of perfect because it, for one thing, it deprives us of one of our senses, right?
Oh, absolutely. And as I say, it just pushes them into this kind of even tighter little space where they have to look at who they are.
Where are they? In a room or in a...
It takes place in the den in a little kitchen area. Mm-hmm. Of the house.
So I guess that presents a bit of a problem for the lighting designer. It just occurred to me.
Yes.
This doesn't all happen in the dark, I assume.
Only the whole first act.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind
of... Well, I mean, it's not in a blackout, of course.
Sure.
They bring things in.
Yeah.
But it's very compressed.
Well, that's kind of a bold theatrical stroke right there, isn't it?
Yeah, it makes it fun for those tech people.
I imagine.
Yeah.
Well, you're in rehearsal now, and
This
is always a stage I think is kind of interesting for a writer to see. The words were just sort of, they were abstractions, right? You didn't have a person attached to them, a voice.
They're collages, of course, as all characters are,
What's it like to watch something take on literal life like that?
It's magic. It's really magic for the writer. And Victoria Gale White is directing, a wonderful cast. Hoko Gilbert and Lisa Barnes lead it, and they're just amazing.
So how many people have we got? How many different sort of relationships?
Oh, it's a cast of five.
Uh-huh.
So there are the two women, the ex-husband Bill, and that's Non DeMello. And then there's the daughter, Jeannie.
The daughter who's about to have a baby. So there's a six.
No, she's about to get married.
About to get married, sorry.
And that's Tracy Olival is the actor. And Des Gilla is coming on as her fiancé, also a doctor without borders, who is from Israel.
Now, you sort of have the challenge in creating production like this of having, I mean, I'm assuming, given that the power outage is the catalyst, that there are a great many emotions that are hinted at the beginning but are openly expressed by the end.
Exactly. And, of course, it sounds all very serious,
but
it's very funny.
Well, good.
Lily is kind of innocently pretentious with her literature thing, and Peg is just, she has a sardonic take on everything, and some of the confrontations are pretty hilarious. So it's a comedy drama.
So there's a little bit of, I mean, and frequently comedy comes from kind of tension and discomfort.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
I think S.J. Perelman said you can't have comedy without trouble.
Yes. And we have just enough trouble to go around.
But you also have just enough trouble to be able to make it be a drama as well. So you're touching on.
Exactly.
What kind of arc do some of these characters go through? I mean, there are realizations for them at the end. What do they move toward?
Well, Lily, I think, makes that sort of ultimate discovery that you can't live your life for someone else.
She is the mother?
She's the mother. She's the sort of protagonist.
Uh-huh.
And she's kind of lived her life for other people.
Including being married.
Oh, yes. For her husband first and to some extent and certainly for her daughter.
And then later in life, kind of rediscovering yourself in a gay relationship, yeah?
Yes, and then especially, of course, finding out that she's immortal.
Yeah. And, of course, setting it in 1982, mm-hmm. families of that kind are becoming more common, but it was still a little bit of a stretch in 1982.
It was a big stretch. If you consider, you say 1982, but actually you're talking about young people of the 50s.
Mm-hmm. And yet 82 was sort of the dawn of the AIDS scare, mm-hmm. very much.
Yeah.
Very many, in a way, one of the things I think would be revealed would be that a lot of attitudes are very different only 30 years ago.
Very much. And the play does not pretend to portray anything about contemporary relationships, straight or gay,
mm-hmm.
Which is important. You know, it really is a look at back then.
Well, it would sort of break the fourth wall if you brought in 21st century mm-hmm. language and insights, and then it would be patently artificial,
right.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So you're pretty happy about this? It's a world premiere?
Oh, it's delightful.
I imagine.
It's wonderful.
Well, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, and it's at TAG.
Mm-hmm. We'll let people know.
Great.
Jan McGrath is the author of Outage, the play's world premiere. It's a comedy drama. Starts August 9th at the Actors Group Theater in Honolulu's Dole Cannery Square. And details are on hpr2.org.
Someone has a dream.
The civil rights movement fight is still happening, but it's happening in churches. It's happening in community centers and in backyards.
An organizer in Youngstown, Ohio, dreams of a new march on Washington to demand racial and economic justice in America. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
HPR listeners who are also station members share in the station's vision to build this network into a truly statewide service. Mahalo to Francis Nakamoto of Honolulu, Michelle and Mike Tsutsui of Mililani, and Mumin El Aji of Honolulu for their membership gifts. A growing number of members are choosing lifetime membership as their preferred way to support HPR now and into the future. Lifetime members pledge a monthly gift of $5 or more, and that continues until you tell us otherwise. To become a lifetime member today, call 955-8821 during business hours or just follow the support link at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 826. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for The Conversation comes from Dr. Vivian Tam, eye physician and surgeon serving Hawaii for more than a decade, announcing a new ophthalmology practice, Pacific Vision Institute of Hawaii. Learn more about advanced eye care at pacificvisionhawaii.com.
The House Majority Floor Leader has a minor problem and the money to fix it. So why doesn't she just pay what she owes to the Campaign Spending Commission before she finds herself in court? It appears she's not telling, not even to Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair for today's reality check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Beth Ann. And, you know, I would take that call if Karen Iwana would call me state representative. Yeah, we're talking about the Oahu Democrat, and her problems with the Campaign Spending Commission are not new. They actually date back to 2008. She has failed to file reports when she has filed reports. Some of them have been inaccurate. And currently the situation is that she owes $800 in fines. That's not a whole lot of money, $800. In fact, her current campaign spending records indicate she has $16,000 that she could draw from. But for whatever reason, she has not decided to do that. She is not returning our calls, and we're confused and perplexed about this, as is the Spending Commission.
With good reason, because it's not as if, you know, she, as you say, doesn't have the money to be able to pay the rest of that fine. But to sort of go along and be doing well up until this point and sort of drop off, that always means something is happening, but usually you got to let them know what. I mean, they've been working with her so far. They helped her to bring everything up to snuff.
They did. They were working with her. There was a payment plan, but then there was this missed check or a check that bounced or didn't clear. I should tell you that this week new campaign spending reports are due from all state lawmakers, so maybe Awana's filing, if she turns it in on time, in fact, may reflect a different balance. I can tell you, though, that the Spending Commission is taking this very seriously. They have subpoenaed Awana's bank records. There is some indication of suspicious purchases. And as you indicated at the top, legal action is a real possibility. It could happen as early as September.
Some of those, you know, sort of suspicious expenses, they're not really big ones, though, right? I mean, they're little things that, you know, you're talking about what, a lay or maybe taking somebody out for coffee or something.
Sure. I mean, you can even buy pizza for your volunteers, but there are other things you cannot do. You can't just treat yourself. There are very strict rules. It's all spelled out on the website. So that's something that the commission is trying to talk to Awana about. What I also wonder here is what the House leadership must think. I mean, Awana is part of that leadership. I'm not sure what Joe Suki, the Speaker, or Scott Sike, the Majority Leader, feel, but this has to be embarrassing to House Democrats. One wonders whether they might be putting some pressure on Representative Awana to come clean and be back in the black, pay off those debts.
Which doesn't seem like it's a horrible thing to do. Just the question is the why and the embarrassment and all the kind of jiggery pokery that has to go on just to kind of get it done. But I suppose we're going to find out pretty soon.
Yes.
And then we'll have more to talk about. But meanwhile, you're standing by that phone, right, in case she wants to call you.
Yeah, I'm right here, Rep. Awana. You know how to reach me. We'll take your call, and we'll see if we can clear things up for you.
All right. Thanks, Chad. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay,
Chad
Beth
Blair
then,
is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And, you know, Kathy, we've known for a long time on an intuitive level that there's a special thing that happens between animals and humans in terms of communication. But now there's more and more science to add to that, yeah?
Well, there's been a lot of research done. And what we're going to do today is talk about a unique way that some people are using horses to help with children in particular who may have communication issues, autistic children in one case, children with special needs. And we're going to talk about how that interaction with an animal, in this case a fairly large one, a horse, can really help these children as a form of therapy.
And there's a couple of programs around the islands where they're doing that with special needs kids, aren't they?
There are, and we're going to talk about how, even if you don't necessarily want to participate just in a program, how you can also just, even as an adult, how you could utilize this for your own needs, take lessons or interact with horses, and how you can structure your own program. So we're going to talk about programs that currently exist, but how you can make it into your own as well.
Well, horses are very, you know, they're great at sensing your state of mind. So if you come near a horse and you're rattled, they know it, don't they?
They know it. You know, animals can sense that. And there's also this wordless communication that you have to develop. And part of the issue with, particularly, for example, children with autism, is that communication with words may not be their preferred pattern. So in that case, they learn to use their communication skills and get that immediate feedback from an animal, and it can really help. We're going to talk about some cases today where kids have really come out of themselves in order to demonstrate to the horse what they need to do, and it helps them as well.
That's great, Kathy. That's inspiring stuff. And that's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5. ¶¶ Good morning. I'm Chris Vandercook, and coming up on The Conversation, paying lip service to low-rent elders, the view from the mountain, and slack steel, southern feel.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travassa Hana, an experiential resort with daily flights to Hana on Mokulele Airlines, celebrating Hawaii through adventure, culinary, culture, fitness, and spa programs. Travassa.com/Hana.
Pick up a Hawaiian dictionary, and you'll find a lot of words starting with K. One we frequently hear is the word for elder or ancestor, and although kupuna brings with it a measure of respect, or should, journalist Joan Conroe says sometimes it's just lip service. Case in point, how the Lihue Court Townhomes, a low-income rental project on Kauai, treated a 95-year-old resident when the building had to be tented for termites. Joan Conroe joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you again, but not necessarily to hear this story. This is pretty upsetting to hear how an elder was treated and not given some really basic assistance.
Yes. When they planned to do a termite tenting of the building that she lives in, she was told, as everyone has to do, that she would have to double bag all of her food and things like that, but she was not given any offer of assistance for doing that. And this is a woman who walks entirely with a walker and, you know, it has very limited strength, and so she was quite worried about that. And then she had to be out of her unit from 8 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday until 7 o'clock on the following, on the next Wednesday, the next day. And so she had asked, they were telling people they would give them one night's accommodation in a hotel, so she had asked for a second night's accommodation so that she would have some place to stay after the checkout time because she needs frequent access to a bathroom and needs to put her feet up and things like that. And they had told her, well, you can wait in our meeting room, which is where there were 50 to 60 Boys and Girls Clubs having their summer session. And so that's when I got involved and helped her bag up her things and put up the money for another night's hotel room for her, and then started pushing the management and also contacting HUD to see if they could provide her with the reimbursement for the hotel room, and also just to make them aware or remind them that there are these federal laws regarding people with persons with disabilities. And but the laws are really only as good as their enforcement.
So, Joan, I mean, you got to wonder, though, even knowing all of this, where was the common sense with a 95-year-old tenant?
I think that's really the underlying issue, Beth Ann, is, you know, we don't always need to be directed by laws, but just our compassion and our common sense can really take us a long ways.
What did they tell you when you contacted management and said, hey, look, we're talking about a 95-year-old woman here. Can you, you know, do a little bit more here?
They said, we're doing the same thing for her that we're doing for everyone else. And I said, but she has different needs than other people, in part because of her age and also because she is legally disabled. And they just said, that's our policy and that's all we're doing. And so that's why I went to HUD. And initially the HUD officer in Honolulu said he thought it was entirely reasonable, and she had also requested that they bring her meals to her at the hotel because they were doing a centralized feeding and she has no car and no way to get back for the meals. So they did agree to bring her the meals, or said they would try to find a way to get her the meals. And then the HUD officer on Kauai contacted the property manager, and then when I called back, the HUD officer on Kauai said that she thought it was reasonable because everyone was treated the same. And I said, but she's disabled and she has these special rights. And then the Kauai HUD officer said, oh, well, the manager never told me she was disabled. And I said, but if you would have called me back and heard the other side of the story or talked to the resident, you would have known more. So sometimes there is this tendency for the agencies to work closely with government, and then the resident is left out of the picture. And oftentimes they're afraid to say anything because they don't want to lose their unit, or they don't even know they have these rights.
Which kind of goes back to the point that people like the woman that you're talking about need to have an advocate. And if you hadn't been there, what might have happened to her is only a wonder. But the idea that somehow the information wasn't transmitted appropriately, that this woman wasn't like everybody else, that she had disabilities that made her different, that was the key that never somehow quite made it to HUD.
Right, exactly. Even though the management was well aware of that, that never got to HUD. And so the Kauai HUD officer said, "This." I talked with her about this on Friday, and she said, well, you know, let me revisit this in light of this additional information, and I'll get back with you. So I'm still hoping that at least this resident will be reimbursed, you know, because she ended up being out for three nights. I paid for one. She's paid for two, and hopefully they'll reimburse her for those two. But
Joan, you know, we're not talking about a lot of money here.
No,
there's more of a principle.
$75 really was it was $75, and I think even if the company itself did not have the money, I would have thought, you know, some manager or somebody could have said, hey, you know, it's just $75, and makes a world of difference to somebody who is elderly, and this sort of thing creates a great deal of anxiety and stress for them because they don't really know what's going to happen or how they're going to be cared for. And so it created a couple of very anxious and upsetting weeks for this woman.
Without painting too broadly, does this really tell us that the way we truly treat kupuna is very different from the way we like to think we talk about it?
I think it's representative of the fact that as our families start to fragment and more people are sort of left to age on their own, they become very vulnerable to the agencies that are the housing agencies that are out there, and maybe just reminding people to make a friend of an older person, because even if they don't need a situation like this, that some, you know, if it isn't a situation like this, there may be other times when they could use some help, or just an able-bodied person who can, you know, help them with what they need.
So you're calling out for us to walk our talk a little bit more than we've been doing, or that we like to think that we've been doing.
Especially as, you know, so many of us as baby boomers, you know, it could be us there in 30, 40, 50 years, you know, and I think it's just important to remember that there's a group of disabled and elderly people who are often not very well tended, and that we need to be thinking about them.
Well, Joan, thanks very much for taking this on of your own accord and sharing the story with us.
Well, thank you for taking the time to let people know about it.
Joan Conroe is a longtime Hawaii freelance journalist. She's reported for the Honolulu Advertiser, Honolulu Star Bulletin, and Reuters. She's also managed an $8 million estate on Kauai, and from 2009 to 2011, worked as the resident services manager at Lihue Court Townhomes, which she says, like the rest of us, need to learn what respect for kupuna really means. More about it's on the website, hpr2.org.
Aloha. Good morning. My name is Lillian Cunningham, retired English teacher from Windward Community College, and you're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Aloha, I'm Dave Lawrence, and this is Stargazer, our weekly guide of what to look for in our island skies. We are joined by Sean Lotch from the Emilo Astronomy Center in Hilo, our official conduit to the research community at Mauna Kea Summit. Hey, Sean, aloha. What are some of the things we'll be looking for in our week of stargazing?
Aloha, Dave. Greetings from Mauna Kea. Last quarter moon is today. It will rise in the east at midnight and set in the west at noon. Venus is in the west and Saturn in the southwest at sunset, and tomorrow you can look for Mercury in the eastern sky at sunrise. Jupiter and Mars are also in the eastern sky in the morning, so watch as the moon glides past them on Saturday and Sunday, respectively. So this week is a great week to see all of the planets visible to the unaided eye in our nighttime sky.
Ah, sounds like it, for sure. Anything unusual happening?
Since August begins, on Thursday this week, it is time to start looking for something known as the zodiacal light. This is a faint, diffuse white glow seen in the night sky that appears to extend up from the vicinity of the sun along the ecliptic or zodiacal plane. It is best seen just after sunset and before sunrise, when the zodiac is at a steep angle to the horizon. It's caused by space dust in that plane, thought to be the remains of comets or possibly asteroids.
I remember looking for that in a previous Stargazer episode.
Yes, it's one of those things that comes around each year, but it's definitely worth a peek.
Yeah, we always like it too. Anything on the satellite or International Space Station front, that kind of thing?
Sure. Tonight, you can look for the X-37B from 7:34 to 7:38 p.m., moving from southwest to east. Friday, look for the International Space Station from 7:20 to 7:24 p.m., moving from south to east. See it again that same evening from 8:55 to 8:59 p.m., moving from southwest to northwest. And on Saturday, you can see it from 8:05 to 8:12 p.m., moving from southwest to northeast.
I bet you'd get quite a view of one of those craft if you were in one of the observatories there on Mount Achaia Summit.
It would be nice if they could do it, but they move so fast that the telescopes really aren't designed to track them. So it would be wonderful. You would get in a spectacular view if you could.
We appreciate the heads up, Sean.
Mahalo for having me, Dave.
You're quite welcome. Sean Lotch, Emilio Astronomy Center on the Big Island, and I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next time here for Stargazer.
Stars may be the common ancestors for everyone. In today's backyard quiz, though, we asked you about a person from Hawaii history. You probably know British voyager James Cook is credited with the European discovery of the Hawaiian Islands. His ship anchored in the Sandwich Isles in January 1778. We asked you if you knew why Cook got an extra special welcome that year. Well, it was Makahiki season, a celebration of Hawaii's abundance when war was forbidden. We gave you that reason earlier, and we mentioned that of all the deities in the Hawaiian pantheon, the fertility god Lono took center stage for the month of this event. That's where the story turns. It's said the Hawaiians who met Cook believed he was Lono's reincarnation. They mistook the ship's white sails and masts for symbols of Lono, often white kapa banners and feather streamers hung on crossbeams. And Cook had appeared from the sea, just as Lono had promised for his return. The mix-up didn't last long, though, and neither did James Cook. His third visit and last voyage ever ended in his death in February 1779. That's today's Backyard Quiz. If you have one, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Paul Mitri, the chair of the Department of Theater and Dance at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
We move now from the history of Hawaii to the beginning of the relationship between Hawaiian music and the blues. That kinship goes back decades. The whine of Hawaiian steel guitar and the cry of the blues aren't that far apart. Classic southern blues artists looked to the islands for inspiration as far back as the 1920s. Larry Dupio grew up in both musical traditions on Oahu and the Big Island and honed his craft with top blues artists during a spell in the Pacific Northwest. His new CD is Lightning Larry Dupio. He's having a CD release party this weekend. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, I thought that title, Lightning Larry Dupio, came from your speed on the fretboard, but you're telling me you got it a different way, yeah?
Yeah, that was a term given to me in the Navy by a good friend of mine, and it wasn't really a complimentary term.
He was being sarcastic.
Yeah.
Like, you know, hurry up, Lightning.
Yeah, yeah. He, good one, Lightning. You know, that kind of a thing.
Well, that's part of the whole thing, way military life keeps you humble, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was quite an experience being in the military. I would recommend that to any young man who needs a little discipline in his life.
You were such a young man?
I needed some discipline.
Well, you got it through music in large part, didn't you?
Yeah, my father was a jazz musician in the 40s, and by the time I came around in the 50s, it was towards the end of his career. So I got to see a little bit of it, you know, but a lot of the stuff that I learned came from my uncles and a lot of my dad's friends. You know, they used to tell me about my dad, and I grew up just hearing, you know, oh, yeah, you know, your father, oh, my goodness, you know, and, you know, it's just something that I felt that I had to live up to as a son, you know.
It's a good way to learn music, though, as a family tradition, isn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, it wasn't really forced on me, you know. I asked for it.
Yeah.
And the discipline part came mostly from my uncles, you know. Mm-hmm. They kept me in line, really. You know, my father was busy just leading the thing. And,
sure.
You know, I was kept in line. My uncles kept an eye on me, you know. They had long arms, you know, people.
Well, you know, Larry, we talked a second ago about the whole way that a certain amount of kinship between Hawaiian music and the blues, in the sense that in blues, and we both are sitting here with our guitars, but we've got this thing where we bend notes, right? We get that sort of... get a kind of a crying sound out of the guitar.
Yeah, yeah. It was sort of a emulation of what was already happening with the steel guitar.
Right.
You know, it emulated those bends really nice. That, and you know.
Real pretty kind of bent blues notes.
Well, sweet that, stuff, you know?
Yeah, we both sort of grew up in that same tradition, didn't we?
Yeah, it's uncanny how, you know, you meet a like personality, you know, in your lifetime, and people come and bless your lives with their presence, and you never really know or even realize how influenced you are by that.
Yeah, it's kind of just osmosis kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and it's because when you like it, you remember it. You remember things that you like, you know.
Well, Larry, let's do a tune together from your new album and do a little bit of that. A little bit of that blues string bending thing, yeah?
All right.
So, one, two, one, two, three, and...
jealous man, I be the best I can. I'm a very jealous man, I do when the best I can. To be with the ones I love is something I can be proud of. Yeah. Thank you so much, Chris.
Well, you know, we kind of inadvertently sort of talked about the two. We sort of brought in the two families of electric guitar, didn't we? I brought in my Gibson, which is more sort of full sounding, and you brought in your Fender, which is a little bit spikier.
Yeah.
And out of that, you know, you kind of forge an identity down through the years, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. It when you work on your abilities and You just can't help but sound like yourself. I know everybody tries to sound like somebody else when they're beginning, but that's just the beginning part. In the end, you end up sounding like yourself. You know, I know that I had designs of trying to sound like Frank Sinatra when I was singing, but
didn't work out that way.
It didn't work out that way. I ended up sounding like myself, and you know, nowadays that's okay. But back then, it was like, oh my goodness.
Well, you know, you try your best to copy somebody you like, B.B. King or somebody like that, and you can't get there. But one day you wake up and it's like, wait a minute, I sound like me, so what's to worry about, right?
Right. Yeah, I thought at one time, I thought Elvis Presley was the best guitar player in the world. And then when I learned how to play guitar and saw the movie, I said, well, wait a minute.
You can barely play.
Wait a minute. He's not, you know.
It's all done with mirrors, Larry.
Yeah, you know, it's something that, you know, when you go to the movies, you don't really realize what goes behind all that stuff. You know?
Well, we learn slowly, don't we? Thanks very much for joining us, Larry.
Oh, you're so welcome, Chris. And I'd like to invite everybody to come down on the 3rd, Saturday, at the venue. I'll be having an album release party. And
we'll tell people about it. Larry Dupio's new CD is Lightning Larry Dupio. It comes out this weekend, and his release party, Saturday night at the venue in downtown Honolulu. You're invited, and you can find details on hpr2.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Kirkpatrick, New York Times Cairo bureau chief. He arrived in the region just before the start of the Arab Spring, covered the Egyptian Revolution, and now he's been reporting on the military's ouster of Egypt's first democratically elected president. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
Well, it's very nice to be back, and all the rain notwithstanding,
exactly.
With Flossie. But
you brought the weather.
Oh, thanks so much. But while we're talking weather this hour, pretty much the same story with Flossie. Heavy rainfall expected this morning over Hawaii County and later this afternoon for Maui County. It is weakening, though. Don't take any sense of complacence in that, because it's... You don't know what could happen with it, and still heavy rainfall is heavy rainfall. So do be safe, and we do have a flash flood watch, and we're going to keep watching what happens. There'll be another complete report about Flossie a little later on this morning, around 11.
Worth keeping track of, isn't it?
Well, worth keeping track of, and you can certainly do that if you got a smartphone, or you can get yourself on there and just know what's going on, because whether it's something that's going to shear off and move away, still... We'd rather have everybody be safe than sorry.
Ever-changeable tropical storms.
Exactly. Hopefully not going to be life-threatening this time around. We will hope that will be true. That's going to do it for us, though, today. Up tomorrow, we're going to talk about supporting businesses one microloan at a time. We're going to talk with one of the partners in a nonprofit offering small loans to deserving individuals in programs that the bank just won't fund.
Plus, keeping a unique poetic voice alive for a new generation of readers.
You've got something you want us to hear? Well, there are lots of ways you can do that. You can let us know on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, tweet us at HI Conversation, or me at BecauseHPR. Email works too. That's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you want to hear any part of today's show again, get another past show, or links to more information, check hpr2.org. It's all there. And I'm Chris Vanderkamp.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation. Stay safe, everybody.